Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
A happy good morning to you. Thank you for listening to the show. Welcome. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I'd like to start with an email that came in actually just a few minutes ago. And this is from Renaud in Canada. He says, first of all, the subject line says, thanks a million. Hi, I'm from Canada, living in a small French-Acadian community in New Brunswick. I've been sick with a rare systemic autoimmune disease giving me massive pain for over 11 years. I fell into a deep depression and started having panic attacks. I did lose all hope of getting better, and even with time lost, my fate stopped going to mass, didn't go to confession or communion. But one day, I don't know why, looking in one of my drawers, I found an old pocket radio and started to listen to some stations with my headphones. I was having nightmares and trouble sleeping and found it helped me to go to sleep. One day, I put my radio on AM and started to tune for a station, and by chance, I found 1390 Relevant Radio in Northern Maine. I started to listen to the Rosary, Daily Mass, and by chance, I found your show. With time, always listening at night now on the internet with my tablet to your show, it gave me the desire to try going back to Mass. So I did. And about a few months ago, I felt the urge to go to Mass. And as you suggested, I had a good confession and went to communion. And since then, I've been going to Mass every week. I even go to church early because they say the Rosary before Mass. So, he says, thanks a million for your show, for Relevant Radio Station. It even reached into a northeastern French lost soul and brought me back to the faith. Thanks and keep up the good work. Man, oh man, isn't that a great message, wow. Cyrus? I'm hoping, Renaud, that you are listening to the show right now, because it's certainly a great way for us to get off to a very positive start. You know, Cyrus, I'm just thinking about how really there are no coincidences when you think about it, and how, as the Bible says, all things work together for the good for those who love God. And there's an example. He wasn't looking for God, but God was looking for him. He found, just coincidentally found his pocket radio, and just coincidentally found Relevant Radio, and just coincidentally found his way back to the Catholic Church.
How about them awesome? Apples? That's incredible. You never know who's listening. And it's another good reason, if you have family members or friends that are not Catholic, point them towards this show and Relevant Radio. And you don't have to, it's not even about necessarily, we talk about so much stuff here. It's not fire and brimstone on Relevant Radio. You know, we're looking at life, like our culture and what's happening here in the United States through a Catholic lens. Point your friends to us and we'll see what happens.
It's good advice. It's so true. I really do believe, and I think Renaud is a great example of this. I mean, who knows? His mom probably praying for him, family members praying for him, other people who care about him praying for him. And all of those prayers coalesced when the time is right and he's going through his sock drawer and he finds an old radio, and that's the way God brought him back. So maybe you can think in terms of somebody that you care about who's away from the faith, away from God, not praying, not going to Mass, doesn't even believe in God maybe. And you may say, that person is so far away from God, it would be impossible to bring that person back. And look what happens. So yeah, I'm with you 100%, Cyrus. Just tell everybody you know about Relevant Radio. Send them a link to the app. Let them know that you have the app. Cyrus, I'm like a factory representative when I'm out and about and I meet people and I say, do you have the Relevant Radio app? No, I don't. What's that? And I pull out my phone and I show them. This is what it looks like. And usually, in the process of the conversation, within a minute or two, I've got them downloading it onto their phone from the App Store.
That's great.
And then I say, here's where my show can be found. And then, of course, you can see where all the other shows are 24/7. And it really works.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Renaud. Thank you. Great way to start the show today. And we can only go, let's go up and up and up from there. 888-914-9149. Let's start in Chicago with Thomas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Patrick. So my question for you is kind of twofold, but I think that the first part might help to illuminate the second.
Okay.
So for my first question, let's say that a person is in a state of mortal sin, but they desire to receive forgiveness and they plan to go to confession. Mm-hmm. However, on their way to confession, if they were like struck by a vehicle and killed, would this person have died in a state of grace and go to heaven? And for the sake of discussion, let's say that this was a person who had imperfect contrition. So Maybe if you wanted to opine on the first question, it might help with the second.
Okay, yeah. And the two actually do go together, so I'll interweave the two in my answer. So, yes, first of all, if the person intended to go to confession, and you'll have to tell me if this fits your scenario, if the person intended to go to confession and was sorry, but mainly because he was fearful of going to hell, but he was still on his way to confession, he intended to go, and maybe he was in the car on his way there, and he got T-boned in an intersection and died, would that fit the scenario? Imperfect contrition?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, the church would say yes, because he had the intention of receiving the sacrament, and even though his life was cut short, he would have received the sacrament. Now, it's not as though God forgives him on the basis of what would have happened, but rather he had made an act of the will, and his votum, as it is in Latin, his choice, his decision for Jesus, even though it was imperfect, the church would say in a situation like that, because he was on his way to confession, that all other things being equal, we could assume that the person would be saved. Now, the second part of your question is also important, and that is that without the sacrament of confession, all other things being equal, once again, perfect contrition is necessary for salvation. So to say an act of contrition, for example, and the words of the act of contrition prayer contain the phraseology about being sorry for your sins more because you love God. I mean, even though you're sorry because you fear punishment, you're more sorry because you love God. And that's where the act of perfect contrition comes in. But I think in a situation like this that you're describing, the person would be over the line in the state of grace, dying on the way to confession.
I see. Okay. So that helps. And then with the follow-up to that, So the reason I outlined the first scenario, I think it helps with the second question, because let's say there was a child who the parents experienced a miscarriage, but the parents desired to baptize that child. Would the desire for the parents to baptize that child be sufficient for the grace of the sacrament to be obtained?
No. So in this case, what you're getting into would be what some people mistakenly think of as baptism by desire. And baptism by desire, or baptism of desire, does not refer to the desire of some other person, so like the parents or even the church. It refers to the baptism, of the desire of the person himself. So in the case of an infant who dies before the possibility of being baptized, even though the parents do desire that child's baptism, the church does not recognize that as baptism in lieu of the sacrament of baptism. Now, if it were a different scenario and it wasn't an infant, but it was, let's say, a 20-year-old who has come to faith in Jesus and desires to be baptized and intends to be baptized, but then dies without having an opportunity to be baptized, that would be a kind of a classic example where the church would say, well, that would fulfill what we think of as baptism of desire. So it has nothing to do with some other person desiring it for the child. Now, the church goes on to say that nonetheless, even though the child dies without the benefit of baptism, that we should trust and hope and even expect, Pope Benedict XVI says, that the Lord will give mercy and provide sanctifying grace for that child in a way that has not been revealed to us. So the norm is that we should be baptized. And baptism is necessary for salvation under normal circumstances. But that's an abnormal circumstance where the person never had a chance to be baptized. So the church trusts in the Lord's mercy and assumes and hopes that those children will be in heaven. It doesn't say that it's necessarily going to be the case, but there's a good reason to hope that it will be.
I see. Okay. Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
You're most welcome. I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's see. We've got a little time, and I've got a lot more of your emails I want to get to. This one comes in from Jeffrey. He says, I need a recommendation for a book to point out the errors of Freemasons for a family member. All right. Well, I'll recommend two. They're both by the same author. His name is John Salza. The first is called Why Catholics Cannot Be Masons. It's the smaller of the two books, but it gives you the overview of the history of the Catholic Church, saying that if you're a Catholic, you cannot be a Mason. It's a serious sin. And he gets into a modification of the church's law from the 1917 code to the 1983 code. And he points out that even though the word Freemason no longer appears, as the church has clarified subsequent to the promulgation of the 1983 code, that it still has the same force of prohibiting membership in secret societies, including the Freemasons. Second book by the same author is called Freemasonry Unmasked, or it might be Masonry Unmasked. It's one of the two. Now, he himself was a 32nd degree Mason, and so he speaks from his own experience in the lodge. He left Freemasonry, became Catholic again. He was raised Catholic, as I understand it. And so he has devoted time and energy to helping Catholics understand what's wrong with Freemasonry. And that second book is where he gives all the whys and wherefores. Again, the author's name is John Salza. Let's go to Diane now in San Bernardino. Good morning, Diane.
Speaking about hell, as that other caller was saying about going to confession, what happens to the babies that are aborted? Where do they go?
Well, the same thing applies, Diane. And thank you for that question. I appreciate it. The same thing applies in their case as would apply for a child who dies, let's say, from SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, or some other accident, or even through miscarriage. The church says that we should assume the mercy and goodness of God for the sake of those children who died before they could have a chance to be baptized. In fact, there's a document that was issued by the International Theological Commission under the auspices of, at that time, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and this was under the pontificate of Pope John Paul II. It was released just, I think it was just before, if I'm not mistaken, the death of Pope John Paul II. But in any case, this document, which goes into all the details here, it's called The Hope of Salvation for Infants Who Die Without Being Baptized, and it includes those who die as a result of a direct abortion, you know, an intentional abortion. So the key to understanding this question is that any soul, and in particular infants, and most especially in this case infants, who die without being baptized, the church does not say, on the one hand, that they go to heaven. And you meet people all the time. I meet people all the time, good-hearted, devout Catholic folk, absolutely love them. And they will say, if they're asked how many children do they have, they'll say, well, we have 5 children and 3 in heaven. And they're referring to the 3 who died in miscarriage. Now, it's every parent's hope and prayer that those children are indeed in heaven. So I don't fault any parent who says that, because I understand what they mean by that. And I understand the desire of their heart that those children will be in heaven. I'm only adding this little asterisk here because it's important to note that the church does not say that they are in heaven. Rather, what the church says is that we have every reason to hope and trust that God will give them the grace necessary to be in heaven. Because if you don't have sanctifying grace in your soul, which is what baptism does for you in the first place, it eradicates the condition of original sin. It destroys any actual sin. In the case of infants, there is no actual sin because they don't have the capacity to commit a sin. Older people do, above the age of reason. But it completely obliterates sin and all of its effects and the effects of original sin, at least the condition of original sin, and it infuses sanctifying grace into the soul. That's what you need to be able to see God face to face. Jesus said, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. And in the condition of original sin, you're not pure of heart because you don't have sanctifying grace. Revelation 21:27 says, nothing unclean will enter heaven. And so even just by doing a little bit of deductive logic here, we can recognize that if it were possible that you could get to heaven in the state of original sin without any sanctifying grace, well, the whole purpose of the incarnation, the whole purpose of Jesus coming to us and dying on the cross for our salvation is a moot point. It's superfluous. It would be unnecessary ultimately, because if we had the ability to go to heaven and be with God and be in a right relationship with God, even though we are born in the condition of original sin, then all of the need for Jesus as Lord and Savior goes out the window. So obviously, it's necessary for there to be a transformation, a rebirth, a regeneration, as the Bible says, being born again, as Jesus says in John chapter 3. And the norm for that to happen is through baptism. So to answer your question again, and this is a really important question, when we talk about we have five children and three in heaven, it's another way of saying that we trust that God will provide a means for those children to get to heaven by giving them sanctifying grace in a way that's not revealed to the church. That's what this document goes into great detail in explaining. And it also talks about limbo, the theory of limbo, and how that was one way of trying to reconcile God's justice and his mercy. The church does not teach limbo as a dogma. It's an opinion that has enjoyed very heavy-duty people in the church, church fathers in some cases, theologians and others, who held to that view, but the church does not teach that as a formal doctrine. People are free to hold it if they wish. So I would recommend this document. We'll get a link posted to this for you so you can read it for yourself. It's well worth your time, especially if you've lost a child in miscarriage or abortion. It would be very helpful. Now, the last bit of what you were saying about today being the anniversary of Our Lady talking to the children and showing them a vision of hell, that's a very important thing. And it's one of the details of Christian history, I think, that helps us understand that even though there are some people who say that, well, hell doesn't really exist, or if it does, there's nobody really there, that's belied by this vision that Our Lady showed to the three children, in which they actually saw hell and they saw demons and souls in hell. And for that matter, it gets us back to an earlier controversy that I had on this program maybe 2 weeks ago. A gentleman called up, and thanks for the call, Diane, I appreciate it very much. A gentleman called up, wanted to dispute with me again over the issue of hell and the reality of the fires in hell. You may remember that conversation. And so I think it was after that break that I came back and I quoted, or maybe it was the following day, I forget which, I quoted from St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologiae and in all the places in which he said, yes, indeed, the fires of hell are real. And I went into some detail on that. So that's a related issue. But in any case, I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can call now. We'll get you on the air right now. Let's see. We have a line or two open. So call now. I'll get you on the air. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Oh, Cyrus, you hear this song? The Chain? Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I hear it.
Check it out, man. I saw Fleetwood Mac when they were doing their Rumors tour. I saw them play this live at the Forum in Los Angeles the summer of 1977.
And set, wow.
Yeah.
That's all right.
It was so good.
That's pretty cool.
And man, I tell you, this song and this part of this song had everybody on their feet.
I bet.
It was a great concert.
Back when music was good.
Yeah. Back when Lindsey Buckingham was still with Fleetwood Mac. What a boneheaded move they did to fire him. Just stupid.
They made all kinds of boneheaded moves.
They did. I actually lost all my, I'm a lifelong diehard fan of Fleetwood Mac, but I completely lost my interest overnight when I heard that Stevie Nicks got in there and fired Lindsey Buckingham. It's like, I'm done.
But it doesn't ruin the music of old.
No, and that's why 35 years ago, hearing that song now just brings me back 35 years ago to, or whatever it is. Was it 40 years? I forget.
Wow, it's 40 years.
Let me think it through.
That's
here.
It's 40 plus years.
77 to 87. It was 44 years 2007, ago. 2007. I was thinking it was like 34. 44 years ago.
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Where has the time gone?
I don't know, but let's make the most of what we got right now. Let's go to Melissa in Mercedes, Texas. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I guess I'm kind of desperate. I don't really know what to do about what my 22-year-old son did this year, getting married without really including his family. He does not live with us anymore, and had gone through another relationship at the end of last year. And within a couple of months later, we find out, basically, we weren't even told or warned about the fact that he wanted to get married to this 28-year-old. Mm-hmm. So, and he's 22, and I'm having a really hard time accepting it. And we've already told him, that we don't condone it. We don't support this. There's a lot of history on her part, and that I feel she's bringing to my son, at such a young age. I don't know who made the decision, but according to them, they spoke about it in 1 month and decided. And I'm like, okay, well, this happened this year, and he kept it from us. And, when I had my suspicions and I saw things on social media, I would ask him, and he would lie, and he's continuously lying, hasn't told the rest of the family.
Can I ask a question, Melissa?
But sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I presume they did not get married in the church, right? There was no time for preparation, marriage prep, or any of that. They probably just got married civilly.
No, okay. Not yet. According to them, they are going to at some point, but I don't know whether, I don't know which route they're taking. I don't know.
Okay.
And
but they didn't get married in the church.
I'm very worried about that.
Okay, understandable, because you're mom and you have a right to be worried, and
yes.
This is a worrisome situation. So I want to, first of all, validate your concern. It's a valid concern, and you're right to feel the way you do. However, this may surprise you, what I'm about to tell you. Have you already voiced to him or put it in an email or in some other way, been really specific about what he's doing is wrong and that you don't approve? And you would like him to change and fix the problem. Have you already expressed that to him?
Yes, okay. Several times.
Okay, so my advice would be go silent and just leave
it.
Okay. Because
that's what I've been trying to do, really. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't mean like zip your lip. I don't mean it like that. What I mean is you just sort of back off. And what I'd like to recommend to you, Melissa, is read the story in the Gospels of the prodigal son. And there's a very similar situation.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to do with a woman necessarily, although there were prostitutes involved, but that's a side note.
Right.
The thing is, much like in your situation, the son basically ignored his father and said, I don't care what you want. Give me my money. I'm going to leave. And he did. And he went off and did his thing. And of course, you know how it ended up. It crashed and burned, and he came home. And very often, that's what will happen in a case like this. And especially, I think anyway, if you as mom and your husband as dad, if you've told him in no uncertain terms, you've done your duty as parents, you've explained to him why this is wrong, well, you've done your duty. And it actually, I think, exacerbates the problem if you continue to harp on it. I understand why you want to, completely understand, but I know it's counterintuitive, but I have found that the best thing you can do, more often than not, is to simply be quiet and let it crash and burn. And eventually it will probably crash and burn. And you'll be there to help him pick up the pieces. And not that you have to say, I told you so, but he'll understand that you did tell him so. And the more you can keep that loving but firm relationship open with him and bite your tongue and not get into it again and again and again, which will have the tendency to drive him further away, I think there's a good chance that when all the dust settles and he realizes the mistake that he made, because chances are this marriage, I mean, anything's possible, but in the world we live in today, the chance of this lasting is not that great. So you can play the long game and wait for things to develop.
And it's kind of hard. And I tell myself, that, you know, I know that, you know, Mary went through a lot with him, with Jesus, knowing that, you know, his time was coming to an end and there's nothing she could do about it. And so the fact that you can't do anything about it is very nerve-wracking. But I do tell God, like, I do ask him, like, please bring me peace, because I have backed off. I have said my piece several times. And I did tell him, like, I love you, you know, but you understand she's not welcomed in my home. I said, and, you know,
Melissa, I can easily imagine all the fine details here. I can easily imagine it in the consternation that you're experiencing. So I'll save you the anguish of recounting all of those things and just say, this is also, there's kind of a double upside here. The other upside is that you have an opportunity now to grow in trust in God. And that's really hard for parents of adult children. I'm here to tell you, because I'm one of them. And as a parent of an adult child, you suddenly now, you no longer have the authority or the influence and the control even over your son that you used to have. And it used to be that when he was 12 or 13 or 8 or 10, you could just fix the problem. You got a problem? Okay, I'm going to fix it for you. You may not like the fix, but I can fix it for you. Well, you can't do that now. So your adult son is a free agent, and he's going to make mistakes and do dumb things as kids tend to do. And so really, this is in addition to you being a good mom and being wise in the way you go about this, you also have the benefit of being purified yourself and becoming a better Christian woman and learning how to trust God more, especially when you have to let go. This is God's problem now more than anything else. You're a very concerned bystander, but there's nothing you can do about it. So try focusing on that. This is, you know, advice from somebody who's been there, and it's not pleasant, as you know, but you'll be better for it in the end. And the more you keep trusting the Lord Jesus, I trust in you, would be a great prayer. Just pray that all the time, especially when those feelings well up in your heart and you're angry or you're frustrated or you're sad. Just keep reminding Jesus that you're trusting in him and he'll bring you through this. I can guarantee that. Thanks, Melissa. Let's go to Victor now in Los Angeles. Good morning, Victor.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Good morning. Well, I'm from Southern California. My question is, are there any examples in the Bible of nonconforming individuals who don't want to contribute to society and are a detriment to the greater good and the
You mean like criminals?
Yes. And how do we learn to not have animosity towards them?
Well, but if by animosity are you referring to feelings of anger and righteous indignation and frustration, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know that I have the answer for you. I suppose I have to try to find that answer for myself sometimes. But in life, you're going to encounter situations or know people personally in your own life who do you wrong. Or even if they don't do you wrong, they're doing wrong and hurting other people. And St. Thomas Aquinas has a whole section in his section on the vices and virtues for that matter too. And he talks about anger And he says, more often than not, I'm paraphrasing here, more often than not, anger is a sin, and it can even rise to the level of one of the deadly sins, which is wrath. But he says there's also a kind of anger which is meritorious. It's actually a kind of a virtue, and that's a righteous anger without which you could never actually rouse yourself to do something good, like defend somebody or to try to make some bad situation better. He talks about how that kind of anger, the righteous anger that doesn't dwell upon injury and doesn't brood and look for retribution, but actually is a way of being roused to take some good action. He says you have to have that kind of anger. But that's not the same thing as being really ticked off because, you know, somebody did something bad. So my thought on that, Victor, would be in the case of something that you can do to make a bad situation better, like you're angry because your 16-year-old son is smoking pot and he's getting in trouble with the police and he's shoplifting, well, your righteous anger at what your son is doing will rouse you to take steps to try to help him get past this problem, you know, check him into a detox center or whatever it may be. That kind of situation is, you know, necessary that we try to do something, but don't fall into anger where you're just grinding your teeth and you're brooding over this and, you know, being eaten up. I think I forget how it was said originally, but somebody said words to the effect that, you know, being angry with somebody is like drinking poison and expecting it to hurt the other person. It only hurts you. So if you're talking about the emotions of anger, I would do everything possible to try to let those dissipate and forgive the other person. Now, one Bible verse that came to mind when you were asking me the question, Victor, is what St. Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 3:10. You asked about, like, does the Bible say anything about how do you handle somebody? Well, he alludes to it in a general way. He says, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. Meaning, if there's some lazy guy, you know, hanging out with the Christian community and he just sleeps until noon and he doesn't really do anything and he's a mooch and he's loafing around and not doing anything, but he expects to get in the chow line when dinner is served, he says, you know, that guy doesn't eat. So there is a cause and effect relationship, as he puts it, between bad behavior and what you can expect by way of privileges. So there's one verse. I don't know if that helps you, but that came to my mind.
It doesn't. I've heard it before. I think as you were saying, just not letting it, not letting any of those bad emotions affect or you know, do too much and fester. So.
Yeah, that's a good word for it, festering, like a sore. The more it festers, the worse it gets. Do you have a situation you're dealing with, or are you just asking in the abstract?
Well, Patrick, since you're a Southern California native, as am I, just the amount of unfortunate individuals that we see all over Southern
Talking
California.
Talking about the homeless people?
Los Angeles, primarily, yes, just the amount of people who are unfortunately addicted to drugs and have don't appear to have any sense of, they're just lost in their addiction and have they have no interest in getting out of it. And of course, with drug addiction, there's, you know, the level of crime goes up. So just one of the many individuals in Los
Understandable.
Angeles who are dealing with those individuals that you see every day.
I was driving with Nancy through Venice not that long ago and just astonished at what once was a very nice beach town, what it has become. It's sort of a mini version of downtown LA with the tent cities and the, you know, drug addicts all over the place. Very depressing. So I can relate to what you're saying, Victor. I certainly can. And I've got something for you. Actually, I came prepared today to talk about some new findings about the causes of homelessness. And I'd like to share that on the other side of this timeout. So please keep listening. I think you'll find some interesting and eye-opening details here. But I'll leave you with one thought, and then we have to go. Jesus on the cross, as he was dying, what did he say? He said, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." So he was invoking mercy and forgiveness, even upon the very scoundrels who were putting him to death. So perhaps as part of your effort to quell your own unruly anger, maybe pray that prayer for the people you see on the streets. I'll be right back.
Relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Awesome song, Cyrus. Well done.
You pointed this one. I've never heard this before. Sorry. But it was cool.
What is wrong? You never heard MacArthur Park before I sent it to you?
Nope. This is the first time I ever heard it.
Wow.
It reminds me, it sounds like it went through the same mixing board as Jesus Christ Superstar. It sounds so similar.
I don't know
to me.
If Phil Spector produced this or not, but you know, the wall of sound effect that he did. Quick backstory on this song. First of all, this is the end of the song. So it's like 45 minutes long.
And it took me a long time to get to a part of the song that I could use.
Yeah. The opening of the song, I mean, it's almost like several different songs mashed together into one single long movement. But it's a ridiculous lyrics that don't make any sense. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it because it took so long to bake it and I'll never have that recipe again. I'm just going from memory because it's ingrained in my brain. But it was just one of those songs that was so different from everything else. Yeah, that's the beginning. Well, actually, it's, yeah.
This sounds so much like Jesus Christ Superstar to me.
But it's not. No, it's not. Richard Harris, actor, he wasn't known as a singer, and a lot of people made fun of his vocal qualities on this. I just thought it was a great song. Ridiculous lyrics, though. All right. MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark. It's almost like they said, well, what words rhyme?
It doesn't matter what we say.
Park, dark, rain, again. Took so long to bake it. All right. Okay, let's move on. I'll tell you what, that is bringing back lots of memories for a lot of people who have a little gray in their hair and remember that song from when they were kids. I'm among them. So I want to get into this serious topic here. So this is the cause of homelessness. And from the Gazette Extra, they've got just a really interesting look at some studies that have been done recently on like what that caller was talking about a few minutes ago. You drive through parts of Los Angeles. It's scary how crazy bad it's gotten with these tent cities and people living on the streets for block after block after block. Whole city blocks and block after block of you can't even get like up near the buildings because there are tents everywhere. And you've got the homeless people who are living there under the freeways, overpasses, you name it. It's just everywhere now. I was up in Bakersfield, I don't know, a month or two ago. And I was talking to some of the folk there and they said, yeah, it's really starting to hit up here too. And it was noticeable as I was driving around. So it's a problem. As I guess is what I'm trying to say. And in some parts of the country, like Southern California, it's a real problem. And you have to ask yourself, are these people there because they can't catch a break? And they really would like to be living in a home or living, you know, some other place more secure? Are they destitute because they can't find a job? Are they really trying to get off the streets, but there's just no hand up or anything? Well, a lot of them, the answer to those questions is no. And I want to share this with you. So just take a listen. A pair of researchers looked at these issues about mental illness, drug addiction, alcoholism, poverty. They looked across the country and they found that they occur everywhere. No big surprise, right? What does vary greatly around the country, they found, was the affordability of housing. So in their book, Homelessness is a Housing Problem, University of California Press co-authors Clayton Aldern and Greg Colburn, they looked at various contributing issues of homelessness, including mental illness and addiction. They looked at the per capita rate of homelessness around the country And by looking at the rate of homelessness per 1,000 people in a population, they found that communities with the highest housing costs had some of the highest rates of homelessness, something that might be overlooked when looking at just the overall raw number of homeless people. For example, in 2019, a count of people in shelters and on the streets found a homeless population of 56,000 in Los Angeles County, 11,200 in King County, and that's in Washington, 9,700 in Santa Clara County, and 4,000 in Multnomah County in Oregon. The homeless populations became similar when looking at per capita rates, with Los Angeles having 6 homeless people for every 1,000 residents, and the other 3 smaller counties having 5 homeless people for every 1,000. And they get to the heart of this. They say what they had in common was a lack of affordable housing. San Diego County, where I used to live, had about 2.5 homeless people for every 1,000 residents, which was about the average per capita rate in the 2019 count. They point out that the San Diego number would be higher if it included just the metro area rather than the entire county. It's an interesting way of looking at this problem, and what they reveal is that, yes, those other issues definitely play a role. Alcoholism, drug addiction, mental illness, poverty, etc. But some of these people, they just can't afford a place to live. And so that leads to the question, well, how do we help them? Some of the people who are on the streets, they don't want to get off the streets. They want that life for whatever reason. I don't understand it. They want it. And maybe it's because they can run wild and do drugs and the police won't bother them and they can just sort of do their thing. Doesn't sound very appealing to me, but there are some people and that's what they choose. Now, obviously, the way they're going about doing it and creating a nightmare of hypodermic needles and human waste on the sidewalks. I mean, there are areas in San Francisco where it's dangerous to even walk around because you might step on a hypodermic needle. So there are all kinds of problems, as you can imagine. But what about the people who don't want to be on the streets and they just can't afford the rent in an area like that? I'm reminded, Cyrus, and I don't remember now whether or not you were on the team at that point. It might have been pre-Cyrus. Or BC, before Cyrus. The show had a BC era. And there, do you remember this? Tell me if you do. There was a guy who wrote in. Actually, he called in, as I recall. And he said, I listened to your show on, he had a phone, inexpensive phone. He says, I have the app on the phone. And he says, I'm homeless. And he said, the reason I'm homeless, I don't want to be homeless, but he says, the reason I'm homeless is they changed the rent control in my apartment building and the rent went through the roof and I could no longer afford it and I can't afford anything else in the city and I've got really nowhere else to go. I think he had some sort of a job of some kind. And he says, I have to be homeless now because I have nowhere to live and I don't want to be homeless. And I remember saying to him, is there anything we can do? If you want to talk to me on the phone after the show's over and see if we can. He said, no. He said, I'm going to trust God. You know, I'm going to figure this. I'm going to figure this out, he said. But I never forgot that guy. He may be listening right now. Did that ring a bell for you?
Yeah, it does. I don't know if I was listening to the show or if I was working with you. But that does. Mm-hmm. And he's not the first homeless person that's called in that's had a phone.
Yeah.
And they've talked about their struggles and I mean, you're always quick to, you know, hey, stay in touch with us and let us help you if we can. I've got homeless people on my dad's side of the family.
Really?
And they choose.
It's currently homeless?
Currently homeless, and it's an absolute choice. They have every opportunity, and they've been given opportunities over and over and over again, and they burn every bridge. And some of it is drug related. I can't help but think it's mental illness related.
Yeah,
but that is a life that they want to live, and I could be wrong. I don't live in California, but they sure seem to make it easy. My buddy lives there, and he rides a bike, and so he'll take little videos for me as he's driving down the bike, and it's street after street of nonstop tents on a sidewalk, and there's garbage everywhere. I mean, it looks like a dump, but it's a street. And he's like, this is a block and a half from my house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just listening to what you're saying and thinking about the things that I've seen. And like you, I just don't understand. I don't understand why somebody would choose to do that. I can easily understand if somebody's stuck in that situation. They didn't want to do that. You know, they lost a job, lost their health, got divorced. Right. The wife gets the house. Next thing you know, you're on the street. Right. So I realize those things happen.
Yeah, but I mean, I was homeless when I was a little kid. I was probably, first or second grade. And I remember sleeping in the car for a week or two. And then, by the grace of God, my mom had a good friend who had a little tiny silver trailer. And we ended up living in this trailer in their driveway for 2 years. It was tiny, tiny trailer. And but it was enough to get her back on her feet, and so she could, you know,
find
a job.
What did it feel like? How old did you say you were as a kid?
I was just a child.
So, like 5, 6?
Right. So
did it feel weird? I mean, do you remember reflecting on it like, wait a minute, I'm homeless?
Not at all. It was just life. I thought everybody was living like this.
Yeah. So, did your mom have to forage for food or get food from like the local food bank or stuff like that?
Well, I know we were on food stamps and she had welfare for a while, but she wasn't very good at jumping through any kind of bureaucracy. So I bet there was even more resources available to us that we didn't take part in just because she didn't like the paperwork or understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I honor that part of your history, Cyrus, because that's a really difficult thing to go through. And I'm really happy that it got better and you weren't living chronically homeless. I'll share with you, and this in no way compares with what you went through. If anything, it just shows how vastly different things were for me. The only time, there was a time when Nancy and I were technically homeless. And the situation was, we had moved from San Diego, and Nancy and I are native Californians, born and raised, live our whole lives there, raised our kids there, at least up to that point. So this was 1997, June of 97, I guess it was. And we were moving to Ohio. And so we had sold our house in San Diego, and we had also finished our lease on the house that we were living in before we moved, because we had outgrown the house that we lived in, that we owned. We had outgrown it. We had sold it. So we were leasing a house. And that lease ended right at the time as we were moving to our new place in Ohio. But we hadn't closed on that house yet. So when we arrived there, you know, the big doot, 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 you know, the Patrick Madrid circus pulls into town with all these kids in this giant van and all that.
And nowhere to live.
And technically. So what brought it home to me, it actually made me feel really weird. I'll share this with you. So we're halfway across the country. And at the time, we only had 9 kids because two of our youngest two were born here in Ohio after we moved here. But so we're on our way through this big family caravan and the 15-passenger van and all that. And our little boy at the time, who would have been 2.5, 3 years old, he said, and he was kind of tired and cranky because it had been several days of driving. He says, I just want to go home. And Nancy and I looked at each other and it dawned on us, we don't actually have a home. It was the weirdest feeling. It's like we can't go back to San Diego because there's nothing to go back to. And we're on our way to Ohio, but we don't technically own that home. And what if the bank says, gee, we're sorry, we changed our mind, or something like that.
And
so it was
real.
Just a very strange feeling. For a week in time, roughly, we were homeless, technically.
Wow. Yeah, it's not a good feeling. And I think it would have turned out very bad for me and for my mom if we didn't have the kindness of friends. And even I'm sure people helped us that we didn't know. And so it's help.
Yeah.
I guess the point is just help. If you're in a position to help someone, help them. It feels good. And they don't even need to know that you're helping them. Just help.
You know, a practical way to do that, we were talking about this study that was done. And anyone who wants to read this article, just go to the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. Cyrus is going to link to it. Or go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. And you'll find a link there on the lower right side. But one practical idea is, if you want to be part of the solution, if you can identify somebody maybe who's going to your parish or something and you find out that the person is homeless, maybe get involved and help them pay their rent. Maybe there's a $300 a month differential that they can't afford, so they're on the streets. But if you could pay the $300 as a sacrificial donation, they can get into an apartment. Maybe as a parish, look into doing this for people who need it, because they're out there. Thanks, Iris. Till tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.